Welcome in, Canucks fans, to episode 151 of the Canucks Speakeasy Podcast. My name is Doug.
Sorry, this is a rum or whiskey or whatever. It's just sadly just water. I'm Brendan, a.k.a. J-Bo. Actually, no, that's water, so that would be vodka, I guess. Yeah, whiskey. That's not vodka.
Could be Everclear.
That's true. It's true. But to know, I'm going healthy tonight. I can't go crazy on a Wednesday night, which is too bad, but it is what it is.
Nice. And we've got three games to quickly run through, Brendan, so let's jump into the game flight.
Well, I got lucky. I went to the game on Friday night. It was as dominant a first period as I've seen that team play in a long, long, long time. I mean, I was sitting in Demko's end. Demko barely saw the puck. And the only bad part of that first period, they only got out of it up 1-0. It should have been a lot worse. And so everybody in the stands was worried. But, you know, could I pull away in the second? And then really were quite lucky to be able to roll a lot of their third and fourth lines, second and third pairing defensemen, and coast to, coasting, Demko had made some nice saves in the third period, but got a nice 5-0 win, and Demko with a well-deserved shutout.
The Canucks then hosted the New York Rangers, and a bit of a controversial loss in overtime as Petey was clearly tripped without a penalty call in overtime, which led to an odd man rush the other way, which resulted in the game-winning goal for Keandre Miller. Filip Peronik, again, looked great. He had 2 assists in that game, and your goal scorers were JT Miller, Tyler Myers, shorthanded, believe it or not, and another defenseman potted a goal, Carson Soucy.
Worst game the Canucks have played since the Philadelphia game against Nashville. They win it 5-2, but it really scrambly, lots of turnovers, and I know Rick Tocchet wasn't happy with the way they played after the game. Pettersson was probably one of the most pedestrian hat tricks, according to his coach, you'll ever see, because he didn't really want to talk about the hat trick as much as he did. He wanted to talk about everything else, which is probably a good thing. You know, don't be happy with the way you play. But they won 5-2. Pettersson with a hat trick, Lafferty with a goal, and I can't remember who had the other one. Miller, after being benched, of course, had the other one. But that's the sign of a good team. You know, you don't play your best, and you find a way to win.
Yeah, I couldn't agree. You don't apologize for wins. Obviously, you know, if it's an ugly win, like, I agree with you. I didn't think the Canucks looked overly good for all 60 minutes of the game last night. But a win's a win. You get the 2 points. They still have yet to give up a point to a Western Conference team, which is great. And yeah, man, I think it's nice. The fan base seems very excited, you know, of this good start. There's a lot to like about the Canucks right now. And how are you, J-Bo? There's no Pete this week. It's just you and I. Pete is trudging through the desert, so to speak. I think he's going from Arizona to New Mexico, and maybe he'll see a UFO. I don't know.
Did he have shrooms with him by chance?
I don't know. But hey, I mean, that might help with you trying to see a UFO, right?
Yeah, exactly, right? You're going to see something, I guarantee you that. I got to go to a hockey game with my dad, which, you know, my dad's 75 years old now. So, you know, not that he's going anywhere, but you never know, right? You know, he's at that age. So it was just a great night to spend with him. And I mean, he's been a Canuck fan since the very beginning, seen way more bad than good. And it was nice to sit down because he was as pumped at the end of that game as anyone was. And is excited to see them play well. And, you know, I mean, this start's been great, you know, for this group, 6-2-1, you know, fans and the team wanted a good start and we've gotten it. So, that night was a good night for me and one that I'll remember for a while.
Well, I saw you tweet the photo of you and your dad at the game. And honestly, like I have to say, like your dad does not look over the age of like 55. For a guy who you said is 75, man, like I'll say, like he looks very good for his age. He does. Like
I got 20 years older. Both my parents look ridiculous for their age. They should not be. I mean, if you looked at them, you're like, oh, really. So, you know, in that respect, I feel quite lucky because, you know, it could be a lot worse.
Yeah, we've got an action-packed episode for you guys. We're going to jump into just our thoughts after the first month of hockey for the Vancouver Canucks. And, you know, we're going to have our three-star segment. Pete has written in who his three stars for the month of October are for the Canucks. But first, you can follow us online. You can follow Pete, who is, like I said, not with us this episode, on Twitter.
He's not dead.
Yes.
He's not dead. He's not with us because he's on vacation. He's with
That's
us.
True. That's he's true. Yes,
not,
yes.
He's just not on the show.
Yes, that I guess the context of the way I said that could be misconstrued. So yes, you're right. That's a good catch. But yeah, you can follow him at Pete_Gas. You can follow me at Doug Venn. And then we've got the podcast at Canuck Speak. And then Brendan.
At JABO_Vancouver. Of course, also on YouTube. So go there, hit that subscribe button. It's right there. So you have no excuse not to hit it. If you're watching this right now, hit that button.
Yeah. And the notification bell as well, right? I mean, that's something that I always hear these content creators say. I don't know. But yeah, hit the little bell too, I guess.
Hey, if there's a button here, fucking hit it.
But yeah, I think we want to kind of start this episode on a bit of a sad note. One a little bit personal to Canucks Twitter, and then another one kind of more of a tragic thing that happened in the hockey world in general. But yeah, a very prominent figure in Canucks Twitter lore, Patrick Petrin, I believe is how you'd pronounce his name. Unfortunately, he passed away the other day. His brother tweeted it out to Canuck fans. I believe it was last night. Or yesterday in the late afternoon, which is really sad. I know he was in the hospital. Again, I don't think any of us know what his medical issues were. But you know, he was a very passionate fan, and you know, you saw a lot of people paying tribute to Patrick and people who would get into pretty heated arguments about Swedish players and their impact on the Canucks and the NHL. But, you know, a lot of the people that did have arguments with him said he was always very respectful, never resulted to name calling. And, you know, it's another sad, you know, person in the Canuck Twitter sphere that has left us far too soon.
I was really, 55 years old, and he was tweeting from his hospital bed.
Yeah. Yeah,
which was, which shows his passion and his commitment, no doubt about that. And yeah, when I saw the post last night from his brother, it just felt awful. It's just like, wow. I mean, you know, yeah, like you said, no one knows what his medical conditions were, what the issues were, but I mean, at no point did I think that this was life threatening. Or at least he never gave the indication, and nor did he have to, that it was life threatening. You know, I had my rows with him, as did a lot of people, but you know, I mean, he always came back for more and, you know, never seemed to take it personally, which is, you know, a lesson for a lot of people who, you know, you get into, to discussions with, and they take it more personally than they should, because this is just sports, guys. This is sports opinions, and no one's is more valid than anybody else's. I mean, we're all going to be wrong from time to time, and you know, it shouldn't be taken personally, and he never seemed to take it personally. So yeah, it's just really sad, and you just feel bad for his family and his friends and the people who you know, knew him the best and loved him the most. You know, you feel bad for them because he was only 55 years old, just very, very young.
Yeah. And, you know, I think just the passion, you know, and I think that's one thing that Canucks Twitter gets a lot of a bad rap, and I get it. But I think just the passion that this fan base has, you know, for this team. And even though 99% of the time we don't all agree with each other, you know, that passion is still there. And Patrick definitely was a very, very passionate Canuck fan. And, you know, I think a lot of us are going to miss interacting with him online.
Yeah, Dix. Like, I mean, and again, I mean, he taught people a lesson. Like, you know, I mean, you're not going to agree with everybody. I mean, you come at your, we all come at our opinions passionately, and We all like to think we're right, but you know, you have to accept that you're going to be wrong, and you know, do it respectfully. I mean, my whole mantra is don't let a Twitter argument get to the point where you wouldn't go grab a beer with that person after.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, I think he did a very good job of that, because he had some very strong opinions, and we didn't always agree with them, but you know, again, he always came back for more, and it clearly he didn't let it bother him.
Yeah, I agree. Well said. And I don't think I could have summed it up better myself. In more tragic news, there is the accident that happened over in the UK. Former Pittsburgh Penguin, teammate of Teddy Bluger and Sam Lafferty, two current Canucks, was tragically killed on the ice. An accident where a skate from an opposing player hit him in the neck. I mean, we've seen this before with Richard Zednik and Clint Mlarchuk. Unfortunately, this incident resulted in him losing his life. We're not going to get into some of the social discourse that's been on Twitter that I'm sure most of us find repugnant, what's going on with what people are saying about Petrograve, I think, is the unfortunate person whose skate is hit Adam Johnson. But I do think, and we saw this today, I don't know if you saw this, Brendan, but the WHL is already implementing net guards as of, I think it's November 6th. Net guards are going to be mandatory in the WHL. And again, very tragic, you know, thoughts and prayers go out to Adam Johnson's family. And, you know, it's just a tragic thing that happens. But I do think this is going to open up a much bigger topic on player safety moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, the discourse and the discussion that came from what happened was just, I mean, if you want to see the worst of Twitter, you go and find, you know, people in the back and forth. And I mean, I posted something and I mean, I saw some pretty bad shit being posted, you know, and because I think at the end of the day, people need somebody to blame and for something like that. And, you know, at the end of the day, no one knows what the intention was, except for, you know, the man who did it. And I mean, I just, in a sport where it moves so fast, I mean, I just find it hard to believe that anybody would intend to have their skate up that high. It's just like, no, it's just ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. But, you know, I like what the WHL is doing. Like, I mean, I look at it in other sports, you know, and like, for instance, you know, Dale Earnhardt Sr. dying in NASCAR in 1999, and, you know, almost instantaneously, they put in place the Hahn system, the head and neck restraints, and that a lot of the old-time guys, like Dale Earnhardt Sr., didn't want to wear. But you know that would have saved his life. And, you know, this is certainly a, I mean, as much as it is an isolated incident where, you know, it hasn't happened a lot, I mean, it like in any way we can to make the sport safer, we have to do it. And, you know, whether that means grandfathering it in, you know, at other levels and letting people make that decision at that time. But if you're entering the league, you only have one decision. Like I believe they ended up doing with helmets. You know, at the end of the day, that may be where they have to go. Cause it's just all about making the sport safer. Cause you've got, you know, 200 to 250 pound guys wearing razor blades on their feet.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've seen people get cuts in different places and it's awful. It is isolated, but you know, it doesn't matter if it's isolated. If it, you know, you got to do what you have to do to make the sport safer.
Yeah. I mean, they did the same thing with visors as well. Like you mentioned helmets, but yeah, visors are now grandfathered in. I mean, I think Kevin BX has got to be one of the last players that I can think of that was skating, or maybe Patrick Maroon's another one currently in the NHL who isn't wearing a visor at the moment, but it's grandfathered in. And it was interesting. Gary Bettman was actually on the Pat McAfee show I don't know if you ever watched the Pat McAfee show.
Right? I do watch that show, but I don't watch full episodes, but I watch clips. It's an amusing show. And I mean, Pat McAfee's made himself a brand.
Oh yeah.
So I mean, good for him, you know?
No, but it's great because his platform is so big, and obviously he's more of a football guy, but you know, he's really been, you know, pumping.
He's a huge hockey fan.
Hockey. I think
he's a big Blackhawks fan, I think.
No, Pittsburgh.
Penguins. Yes, exactly. Right. Yeah.
But he had Gary Bettman on his show today. And they were talking about a lot of things, and it was just amazing watching Bettman react to a guy like Pat McAfee, because obviously, you know, Bettman's used to, you know, things being kind of structured and like, okay, this is, you know, the question you ask or whatever. But they brought up about player safety and, you know, the tragedy that happened over in the UK with Adam Johnson. And, you know, Bettman brought up a good point. He said, look, a lot of these things are already there for players to use, but the PA chooses for them not to use it. You know, the Players Association, you know, isn't keen to make these drastic changes to their equipment, but there are Kevlar shin pads to protect against, you know, your skates accidentally stomping on your leg. There's Kevlar pads for your wrists and stuff like that. A lot of the stuff is there, and players, for whatever reason, just don't want to use it because they're not used to using it or whatever. And, you know, I do think we're going to see the change. And, you know, Bettman did acknowledge that, you know, they are going to have discussions moving forward with the PA. And I'm sure there are a lot of players that this is maybe a bit of a wake-up call. I mean, TJ Oshie apparently is a guy who's got a little side hustle business where he, you know, he sells Kevlar shin guards and wrist and neck protectors, and yet he never wears them, you know. And so he said, even for himself, you know, yeah, you know, I've really got to kind of take a long look at the mirror at what I'm doing, and you know, I've got a family, and you know, I need to protect myself out there. So I do wonder if in the next 5 years we will see neck guards mandatory across the league.
Well, it's probably Bieksa didn't wear a visor, but Bieksa did wear Kevlar leggings, I believe, because I think he had a skate cut to the back of his leg that was quite serious. So, you know, it is like those sorts of incidents are isolated. But again, when you've got, you know, 10 guys on the ice, you know, 12 with goalies on the ice at any given time, and they're all wearing razor blades, you know, I mean, you know, stuff can happen. And so...
Well, they're also going skating 30 to 40 miles an hour on that ice at times, right?
Exactly,
like there's speed as well involved. It's a crash course on that ice at times.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I mean, I like the idea of bringing it into the lower levels. I mean, I would like to think that the WHL is just the first in what I hope will be at least a few more of the junior leagues implementing that, because if you can get players used to it at that age, it makes it easier for them to use it when they get older.
I agree. Yeah, I totally agree. But yeah, let's move on to the local team here. I mean, we are a Canucks podcast after all. We're essentially 1 month into the season. Now, I know technically the season started, I think game one was October 9th, and today's we're recording on November 1st, but I'm calling it a month into the season. You mentioned it earlier, Brendan, the Canucks are 6-2-1. What are your thoughts of this team after the first nine games of the season?
I mean, you have to be happy, you know, 6-2-1. I don't think anybody, you know, even the most, you know, positive person would have expected that, given that they, you know, you play one game at home, but you start with back-to-backs against Edmonton, and you know, a quote-unquote Stanley Cup favorite. Now, I mean, you could argue that maybe they're not looking at like it at the moment, but you get through that, and then you get through a five-game road trip, and then you come home for three games, and against, you know, I mean, you got the Rangers, who are a you know, some would say a Stanley Cup contender, and you know, two teams that are sort of in that bubble, for possibly a wild card spot in St. Louis and Nashville. And you know, you're 6-2-1. Structurally, after that game in Philadelphia, they slowly chipped away at the way they wanted to play. I thought they looked very good in Nashville. I thought they looked fantastic against St. Louis. and then played really, really hard in a back-to-back with their backup goalie in net against the New York Rangers. And really, you know, if Kuzmenko finishes one of those chances, if the refs do what they're supposed to do, which is their job, which is called a penalty, you know, which I think most people are like, I mean, I don't get, like, it doesn't matter who you're a fan of, you know, I mean, you could be a fan, not a fan of the Canucks, and you watch that play, you're like, oh yeah, well, that's a trip. So that's not a homer thing to say that. That's just a fact. It was a penalty. We know it was a penalty. And then, you know, I mean, the game against in Vancouver against Nashville, which is probably the worst game that they played in the last little while. But I'll say that about this game, that game is, you know, as just disjointed as they looked. I mean, I just felt they looked slow. It was one of those games that, like, you know, even when the Canucks were really good, Tuesday games were always difficult. There just seemed like those midweek games where it's just there's a malaise in the crowd. And just the team, just, you know, those games, for whatever reason, in Vancouver have always been hard to get up for. There were times, even, you know, in and around the 2011 season, where they just did not look like just really sharp, like they were ready to play. And so that's kind of what we got. But I will say this, structurally, you know, I thought they were okay. I thought they were disjointed at points. I thought they were out of position at points. I thought they turned over the puck, you know, cheaply at points, but it never got overly chaotic. They never looked like they were totally out of sorts, which is what we would have seen in the past, which is what I was happy about. Now, obviously, you want to fix everything else. And it to me, my hope is when they go to play San Jose, you know, a team that hasn't won yet, you know, you can use that game as a launching point. Like if they go and they beat Nashville 7-0, I mean, it's a lot easier to look past that San Jose game. But the fact that they didn't look very good, and that the coach came out after the game and called them out, you know, even called out, you know, Pettersson, who had a hat trick, for all his mistakes. And to be fair, Pettersson wasn't great for a guy that scored a hat trick. And even he admitted as much. So, you know, my hope is tomorrow night in San Jose, you get a team that, you know, really, really learned a lesson and is ready to come out and play a much better game. Almost like I compared it last night to Belichick. You know, Belichick always loved games where, you know, they would win, but there was something within that game that he didn't like, that didn't look good, because it meant the next day he could go and absolutely shit on them in practice to just say, hey, you look at what you did here. You really, I mean, it kept them motivated. So, you know, that's my hope, is that they come out in San Jose really motivated to play a much better 60-minute game.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the only game you wouldn't criticize how ugly of a win it would be if you won the Stanley Cup or you're winning the Super Bowl. It's like, hey, we won. It doesn't matter how ugly it was, we won. But I think the biggest thing for me this year is just, you know, I know there was a lot of people, and myself included, that had a little bit of, I don't know if concern is the right word, but, you know, just, it was a looking
at, probably the right word.
Yes. With Rick Tocchet, right? Just the fact that, you know, he was associated with Pittsburgh as well as Rutherford and Alvin, and, you know, just the Pittsburgh connection was just becoming a little bit too much. But to Rick Tocchet's credit, though, I honestly think he's been a breath of fresh air in this market. Even media guys in this market who are usually pretty critical of the team, the coach, the players, have actually been singing Rick Tocchet's praise. And, you know, the fact that he has been critical of the team, even after a big win like last night against Nashville, where they win 5-2, they win by 3 goals. You know, I know I get it, one was an empty netter, but still, they win by 3 goals on home ice on Halloween night. And Tocchet is like, yeah, no, there were some issues. Obviously, you know, we can talk about the man behind you getting benched for the final 4 minutes of the second period. Pettersson, like you said, scored a hat trick, and, you know, the coach still was pretty critical of him. In my opinion, I thought the three best players of the game last night, Hughes, who had 3 assists, again, this guy looks like a world beater at the moment. In my opinion, him and Miro Heiskanen are kind of 1-2 for the Norris Trophy. I know it's still early in the season. Demko actually made some pretty big saves last night to keep Nashville at 2 goals. and the other guy who I honestly think, I know we're talking Hughes, I know we're talking Pettersson, JT Miller, Demko, but honestly, the guy that I think is making, I don't know if the biggest impact on the team, but I'll say the most important impact on the team for me in the first nine games has been Filip Hronek. I think Hronek, I know the first game it was an 8-1 drumming of the Oilers, and even the second game we got the win, but we were badly outplayed against the Oilers. But Hronek has progressively gotten better and better and better every game. And this pairing between him and Hughes, and I know last night was the first game and it was funny because both goals against, they were on the ice for 5-on-5, but it was the first time 5-on-5 any team has scored against Hronek and Hughes, the Hronek and Hughes pairing on the ice. But to me, he's been a difference maker out there. Just his calm and coolness and his defensive instincts, right? He's not the most flashy guy, but you can just tell the way he can read a play in the defensive zone. And, you know, he's always in the right place at the right time. And for me, he's been one of him and the coach have been my two biggest X factors onto why this team has had such a good start within the first nine games.
I'll say Hughes last, obviously had three assists. I'm not going to, but I mean, his first period, that was probably for me the worst period he's played all year. That first period. Yep. Cause his turnover directly led to the first goal. It was a pass that you don't not used to seeing him make, but you know, I mean, that's what makes him such a good defenseman is that, you know, he can make a play like that, but he's got that elite talent to make up for it very quickly. And so, you know, despite that, and I'm fairly certain talk is going to harp on him about, hey, you can't make that mistake where he did. And another guy for me from that game that I liked, he's not doing it on the score sheet as of yet, and I hope he will, but to me, whose defensive instincts are really, really fantastic is Pia Suter.
Yeah.
There were a couple of plays in that game where if he's not in the right place and not reading that play well, it probably ends up, if not a goal, a glorious scoring chance in front of the net. So, I mean, he has that ability to know, to sniff out chances, to know where the opposition is going to go with that puck, and he seems to be in the right spots more often than not. Now, if he could start finding that offensive touch, that all the better, and maybe he will over time. But from a defensive standpoint, I have liked what I've seen. You get a guy like Bluger. I mean, that's kind of the forgotten element of this start is that they're doing it and they haven't had everyone in the lineup as of yet. Teddy Bluger's yet to play a game. I don't believe Teddy Bluger's even skated since the season started yet. So
yeah, like has there been an update at all on his injury? And like, do we even know what the injury is? Like, I don't even remember them saying what it was.
I think he has a broken foot, I believe.
Okay.
Because I remember in that last preseason game, he did take a shot off the foot.
Yes, you're right.
And so that might be what it was, but I don't think they've confirmed it, or at least not that I've heard. Maybe they have and I just missed it. The PK, I thought, was much better. I mean, to be fair, I didn't think the PK was that bad against the Rangers. I said it before the game, you can't give that team power plays. That's a team that went into that game with a 30%, you know, success rate on the power play.
Well, especially two 5-on-3s as well against.
Yeah, well, exactly. Rangers, right? Well, that was the big thing. Cause I really didn't think that they were that bad 5-on-4. I thought that they were actually quite good 5-on-4. It just unfortunate, you know, you have the Hronek over the glass penalty that, you know, I mean, we can argue until we're blue in the face whether that should actually be a rule in the league anymore. I understand why it was put in the first place, but I do wonder if there's a reason to have it, if there's a reason to at least, you know, critique that penalty, because that clearly wasn't intending to do that. And the too many men on the ice penalty, which, you know, I didn't like it. I thought it was a cheap penalty for them to call at that time, especially when they're down a man. I mean, you know, don't have to make that call. So, you know, I didn't really think that they were that bad on the PK, and so that's why I wasn't, I mean, you know, I wasn't all that concerned going into the Nashville game that that was going to explode into something much, much worse. So, but still, even it was still nice to see them go 4-for-4 on the PK. And, you know, they're 77% on the PK so far. And somebody had said that they were that they were bottom dwellers still, and they're not bottom dwellers. They're 16th in the league right now in PK percentage. Much better than they were in the past, but they were right around this time of the year. They were, you know, basically at 50%. Much better, and probably one of the major reasons why they are 6-2-1, because they've had you know, games where the penalty kill has come up big in critical times. The game in Nashville, for sure, you know, was probably a good example. Florida as well, another good example. You know, you've had games where, you know, penalty kills have, you know, made the difference in comparison to last year where it was going the other way around. So, you know, last night's game, I hope they use, you know, what they did poorly as a catalyst to come out again, like I said, against San Jose and really play a smart, solid game. Because if they play smart and solid against that San Jose team, they're going to give them chances. So just play well defensively. Play well defensively, and they're going to gift wrap you something at some point. And, you know, the Canucks have the skill to take advantage of that.
Yeah, I mean, the San Jose game feels like a trap game just because they're winless in the season.
We're all scared of it, right?
Of course. Mackenzie Blackwood's their goalie who stunted on the Canucks when he played for New Jersey. You know what I mean? But I do think the fact that the coach and the players, like Quinn Hughes, to his credit, post game last night was also critical of the team. He says, hey, we got the win, but there's definitely things we need to tighten up and be better. You mentioned Petey admitted himself that it wasn't his best game, right? It was, you know, there was definitely some holes for this team to kind of sort out. The one thing I will say that has concerned me a little bit within the first 9 games, and I know the reffing has been very critical, like Canuck fans have been very critical of the reffing after these first 9 games, but the Canucks are taking, in my opinion, too many penalties. Now, are some of them justified? Some of them not justified? Like, I know, you know, JT Miller got a double minor last night. He got the hooking call, which he was kind of getting chicken winged by Forsberg there. So Forsberg helped sell that call. And then he got a unsportsmanlike misconduct, which you very rarely see called. You see players yelling and screaming and, you know, yelling obscenities at the refs, and they never call an unsportsmanlike penalty against the player. So I do wonder what happened last night for the ref to trigger calling the unsportsmanlike penalty, because you never see it. And I also thought it was funny because no one was really defending Miller for getting called an unsportsmanlike on online last night, because I thought, like I said, you very rarely see that. But that is the one thing I do worry about, is this team is seemingly taking a lot of penalties, whether rightfully or wrongfully. And the more opportunities you give to the opposing team's power play, the more your penalty kills on the ice, the more susceptible you are to get scored upon. So that is something I would like to see this team tighten up. And I you know, I guess Rick Tocchet, that was one of the reasons why he benched Miller last night. He had that double minor, and then he took another bad penalty near the end of the second period, or close to the end of the second period. And then he benched him for the rest of the second period, which I think sent a strong message. It's like, hey, you know, we've seen JT Miller over the past couple of years. I think it's great. He is one of the emotional drivers of this team, right? This team doesn't have a lot of loud vocal guys. We've heard it from Rutherford, Nelvin, and Tocchet that it's a quiet team. And Miller's one of the few guys that is willing to kind of try to get the guys riled up. But he has gotten a little too emotional at times on the ice, and it's cost this team, whether it's a giveaway, whether it's him slamming his stick on the boards, barking at a teammate, which again, I don't have issues with, but you know, when it, you could tell that his emotions get the best of him. And I thought it was really great, you know, and I know there's some criticism that he wasn't, you know, made available to the media last night and whatever. But I actually thought, you know, Miller came out, he started the third period, won the faceoff, shortly thereafter drew a penalty on Forsberg, and then scored the go-ahead goal, which ended up being the game-winning goal. Or no, it wasn't the game-winning goal. Pardon me. It was the fourth goal. Yeah, the insurance goal. But, you know, it was great. You know, Miller responded, I thought, very well. And Tocchet post-game said, yeah, you know, they talked it in the intermission. Tockett apologized to him. Apparently Miller apologized to him, and they moved on. And I love that. I love seeing that.
JT Miller is best when he's playing on the edge.
Yeah.
When he's at his best as a hockey player is when he's straddling that line. And, you know, like a lot of players who play that way and are exceptionally good when they're on that edge, at some point they're going to go over the edge. And that's when it's the coach's job to rein him in and remind him, hey, you know, don't stop playing close to that edge. Just know where it is and know when you're crossing it. And I think players need that reminder, you know, and, you know, again, it's never to tell the player, stop playing with that edge. It's just know where it is.
Yeah.
So you don't cross it. And last night he crossed it. And you know, it's, you know, a reminder to him from the coach that against another team on another night, you know, crossing that line could cost your team 2 points. And, you know, so I thought it was, you know, a great reminder because it's not going to be the last time it happens. There's going to be another instance in an 82 game season with a guy like JT Miller who plays the way he does, where he's going to go over the top of it, and he's going to have to do it again. Do I have a problem with him not speaking to the media? No, I mean, whatever. I mean, he spoke to the media this morning. I mean, you know, and he's an emotional guy, and you know, just like when, you know, anybody when they in life, you know, it's better to speak when, you know, you've cooled off and you've had some time to think about things a bit, which obviously he did overnight, and he came in and he spoke to the media, and that was that. Obviously the media wants him to talk when he's, you know, when things are bubbling at the surface, but, you know, I think from the standpoint of the team and what they're trying to accomplish, it was smart to not do that, to not have him speak. Let him cool off, let him think about it, and come back the next morning and speak more candidly, which he did. I mean, you know, I look at the game last night and, you know, I was thinking about it today and, you know, what this team's trying to build and what this coaching staff is trying to build with them is a consistency. And, you know, you look at that 2011 team, they would lay an egg every once in a while, but because they had built up that sort of consistency over time, you were more willing to give them a pass on certain things. Whereas with this team, they're really in the infancy of this. This is really just the beginning, you know? So, you know, we're in the infancy of the team playing this way. We're only like really what, 8 games in? Nine games in of playing this certain system and this certain style that Tockett wants. We're really just starting to scratch the surface of what this might be. So they don't get the benefit of the doubt if they play a game like they did in Nashville. You know, they just don't. They have to be more able to be consistent, because let's be honest, there's a lot of teams that go on winning streaks. They get really happy about themselves, and that's when things start to cave in a bit. It happens even with really good teams, and this team can't allow that to happen. And I applaud Rick Tockett because he's really trying hard to keep this team focused, keep this team understanding that they really haven't, you know, as good as 6-2-1 is, you know, there are a couple of losses away from this for them really, you know, kind of getting back to an average start. So, you know, really start and continue to push forward and try to really build that consistency. So as they continue to tinker this roster, as players move in and out, you bring in new players and they know where that standard is. Because I really think that was the problem in the past when you brought players in. There was no standard set as to how they wanted to play, as how they should play. So a lot of players came, like Jason Dickinson, for instance, came in here and failed. And I believe to my core it had nothing to do that Jason Dickinson wasn't a good player. I think that the system, the way they were playing, was rotten. And a lot of players would come in there and fail. And a lot Nate of players Schmidt. Did come in there and fail.
Nate Schmidt,
you know. So what they're trying to build is that sort of culture where, you know, as this roster gets altered and changed, you're going to bring in new players with the best possible chance to succeed, which, you know, which is what they built in between 2006 and 2011. It's what they built.
Yep.
So you brought in guys like Chris Higgins. You brought in guys like Christian Ehrhoff. You brought in, you know, whoever you want to add, like Yannick Hansen, guys from their system. And they were brought in and they were given the best possible chance to succeed. And I think that's what this organization, what this coaching staff is trying to build with this group. And the early returns are good, but it's important to remember that they are just very early returns. And I, again, I applaud the coach for continually trying to remind this group that you haven't really accomplished anything yet, that the season's long and you're going to go through some tough times. But if you keep that consistency, you're going to be able to get through them much easier than you otherwise would have.
Well, and I think it's just you hold everybody to the same standard, right? Whether you're JT Miller, Nils Höglander, Tyler Myers. I mean, Tyler Myers had two horrific games back-to-back for the Canucks. He has been bumped down to the third pairing. His minutes have now been sheltered, and he's playing much better because of it. You know, he's playing more.
He was up to 19 minutes last night. So, you know, and I don't know if you heard this, but I heard this today. I had no idea. Apparently, during that terrible stretch of games, he actually texted Rick Tocchet to apologize for the way he was playing. I had
really?
No idea. I didn't hear that. Yeah, I heard that today. I was like, wow, okay. I mean, and again, like, you know, people are hard on Tyler Myers, and a lot of it rightly so. If he's not playing well, you're going to get criticism. It's just the way it is. But, you know, we should never question, you know, how much he clearly cares. I mean, when things go wrong, I mean, you know, it clearly affects him, and he clearly wants to be a better player. And it's nice to see over the last few games, him starting to round back into form. And because they're, I mean, if he's going to be here all year, which he might be, they're going to need him because he's a right shot veteran defenseman with some size who can kill penalties. And, you know, I mean, he's created offensively as well, has a couple of goals.
Yeah, but the fact that everybody's held to that standard, and like you brought up Bill Belichick, and I'm a Patriots fan, and you know, one of the things you hear back about the Belichick Brady era was he was hard on Tom. He would yell at Tom in front of the team, the best player, you know, the greatest quarterback of all time to a lot of people. And he held Tom to such a high standard. And you know, Tom flourished under that, and you know, it brought the best out of Tom, and Tom became this great player. And I think, you know, you're seeing a similar thing with Tocchet at the moment, you know, in the way he's holding all of his players accountable. He doesn't care if you scored a hat trick, you know, or you had the insurance goal, you know what I mean? And you bounce back after taking two bad penalties and scored a goal. He's going to, you know, I don't think publicly criticize you like a way John Tortorella does, but you know, he's going to hold you accountable and be like, yeah, look, obviously it's great. PD scored three goals, but you know, he had troubles keeping the puck on his stick. He was fighting the puck all night. You know, he was kind of chasing the game instead of, you know, dictating the game and controlling the game, which we normally see PD do. I think that it is a breath of fresh air. Boudreau, I think, is very much a player's coach, and he just kind of let the players play, which I get, you know, that works some of the time, but very rarely does that type of coaching style get you to the pinnacle of a championship, a Stanley Cup. You know, you need to be able to lay the hammer down on your best players, and you can't be afraid, you know, to tiptoe around them or to, you know, challenge them when they're not at their best. And I think that's what Tocchet's doing. And I think the key, much like the Belichick Brady thing, is the players have to buy into that too. You know what I mean? They have to buy into this. And I think, you know, this core, Petey, Hughes, Demko, those are the three main guys. You know, Miller, I'll add in there as well, but Miller has had some playoff experience in his career prior to coming to the Canucks. These guys really haven't had actual playoff experience. I know the bubble was technically playoffs and they won, you know, two rounds. They beat Minnesota, they beat St. Louis, who were the, you know, defending Stanley Cup champions at the time. But to like actually play a home playoff game in front of this fan base, none of these guys have had that. And that was the other controversial thing yeah, I guess controversial thing that came out of last night was, oh, Petey said it's fun to play here now. You know what I mean? There was people, oh, what does he mean by that? I just think the fact that they're winning and the crowd is happy and the players are happy to go to the rink. You know, we heard Brock Besser in the offseason, you know, talk about how he lost the love of the game. You know, he didn't enjoy being a hockey player and he kind of reassessed, you know, where he was in his life and he wanted to have that fun again. And, you know, we've seen a massive improvement in Brock Besser this year defensively. He looks much faster, you know, on the ice as well. Like he's still not, you know, the best skater in the world. Either is Petey, but he definitely looks much faster. He's harder on the forecheck. You know, he's winning those board battles. And, you know, these are all signs that this team is heading in the right direction, you know, and I still think a team like Edmonton, there's just too much top end talent for them not to make a push and to, you know, be there for at least a wild card, if not a playoff spot. Calgary, I think, you know, I think Calgary's done. Like, I think even Craig Conroy is willing to pull the shoot on Calgary. Yeah. And, you know, Seattle, you know, looks like an expansion team again, which I don't think too many people are that surprised with, but, you know, I do think this team, this Canuck team, has a very, very legitimate shot of being a playoff team this year.
It starts with winning.
Yes.
Because if your coach is going to chew you out and what he's telling you clearly isn't working, that grows thin very quickly. So it starts with that. I mean, I look back. I mean, if you talk to the guys that were, you know, there, you know, and, you know, in AV's era as coach, I mean, he rode his best players. He rode the Sedins harder than he rode anybody. And he was hard on them. And I think that Sedins understood that. And I think, I mean, there's an understanding made quite clear from the coach to his best players that this is what I'm going to do to you. Yeah. I'm going to do this. I'm going to hold you accountable. Because if I'm going to hold everybody else in that locker room accountable, and I don't hold you accountable, it's just not going to work. And so if I'm harder on you than I am on anybody else, it's going to make everybody stand up and listen. It's one thing to chew out Dakota Joshua, you know. It's another thing to go and give an honest critique of your best players when their performance isn't quite where it should be. And you know, the rest of the locker room is going to hear that. And you know, and we'll see in San Jose, what the response is, but certainly I think that's important. You know, accountability is really important. I mean, I always said that, you know, that Bruce Boudreau was the right coach at the wrong time. There are situations where Bruce Boudreau will work. And usually it's after, you know, you have a stern taskmaster of a structure coach in there, which is, you know, what happened in both Minnesota and in Anaheim. He took over for, you know, coaches that were very, very strict, very, very structure oriented coaches. And you bring him in there to loosen the reins a bit, to give these guys some positive reinforcement, because you know that structure is there. You know it's there. It's not going to leave them. So he can then implement his system, knowing that these guys know how to play 200 feet hockey. This team didn't know how to do that. You know, and it can't just be like, you know, the problem with the previous regime was that rather than get a coach in there that was going to teach all of them how to play that way, they threw Band-Aids at it. So you go and you sign Jay Beagle. You know, you sign Antoine Roussel. You sign Jason Dick. You know, yeah, you sign Jason Dickinson. You bring in players that could play system-oriented hockey, but you bring them into a situation where no one else knows how to do that. And so, you know, that's not going to work. The only way a team can be good structurally and defensively is if all forwards and all defensemen are on the same page. You know, you can't throw players at that and think, oh, voila, it's fixed. So, and that's why I'm quite happy with, you know, because I've had, you know, long discussions and arguments with people who would tell me, oh, this Canuck team isn't capable of playing with structure. that this roster isn't capable of playing well defensively. And I said, that's fucking bullshit. We've seen it. I've seen it over and over and over and over and over and over and over again with teams that were bad defensively that just needed a kick in the ass from the right coach.
Look at Ken Hitchcock in Dallas. And ask Brett Hull. Brett Hull, ask Brett Hull what he thought of Ken Hitchcock. And, you know, he hated him, but they won that Stanley Cup. And Hull is forever grateful to him for that.
Barry Trotz in New York is probably on Long Island is probably the best example of taking the worst defensive team and making them the best defensive team. And everybody's like, oh, the argument I got from some media members was like, well, that's Barry Trotz. He's one of the greatest defensive coaches of all time. And I'm like, well, no shit. But it does show you that it's possible. You just need the right coach. And this coach came in, Rick Tocchet, with the mandate that we're going to get better defensively. And he's holding these guys to a strict, to a very strict standard of principles that he expects you to uphold. And if you don't uphold them, whether you're Elias Pettersson or you're Sam Lafferty, you're going to hear about it. And that's how you build defensive responsibility. That's how you build structure. And that's how you have a team that, you know, outside of a couple of games is really starting to grasp the concept that if we play better defensively, it's going to lead to better offense. And again, we're in the infancy of it. Who knows? Maybe tomorrow it goes all wrong. But right now, it's at the very least, it's promising for what we might see, not just for the rest of this season, but what I hope for the next few seasons.
Yeah, I think the game this Saturday against the Dallas Stars will be a real litmus test to see where this team really is, because Dallas looks great. They've got a similar lineup in some ways. I mean, the Canucks don't really have old stars like a Sagan or a Ben on their roster, lineup.
But it is similar. They don't have a ton of superstars, but they have some really good superstar players and game changers, and a very good goalie. An elite puck moving defenseman, and players that have built in or that have bought into playing a sound defensive game, which it's the only way you win in this league. You can't win, like, so few teams can win in this league by playing run and gun. It's just not feasible. You have to learn how to play defensively, not just your bottom six players. Every single player on that roster has to be willing to do the things necessary in their own end to win hockey games. That's the only way you do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's the only way you become a Stanley Cup champion, right? Is your best players have to be willing to sacrifice their bodies and, get in front of pucks to block shots. We saw Petey and Miller play PK time last night and in the Ranger game as well. I believe Miller got the shorthanded goal in the Rangers game, I believe, one of the games he got a shorthanded goal. I thought it was the Rangers game.
He had a shorty in the St. Louis game.
It was the St. Louis game. Okay. But
Myers had the shorty in the
Rangers. That's right. It was the Myers. Yeah. Totally unexpected.
How could you forget that?
Sorry. No, that was insane. That was insane. But yeah, I, it's been a very solid month, I think, to start the season for the Canucks.
Just nine games.
No, you're right.
That's not just for you. And that's not to remind you. That's to remind everybody, including myself. It's just nine games.
No, you're right.
73 more to go.
But let's get to our three stars for the month of October.
I think he'll be back for an encore yet tonight. Fans haven't left. They're still here. There's still the three star selections to come.
So Pete did write in what his three stars were. So I'll read his three stars off. And then if you want to go after Brendan, and then I can do mine last. So Pete, his three stars for the month of October. Number three is JT Miller. He's second on the team in scoring. Really helped Brock get going, anchoring a solid second line, Tocchet kind of player. His second star is the new captain, Quinn Hughes. He's been incredible. He's pacing for an 80-point-plus season, which I did predict, Hughes would be a point a game player at the end of the year and have over 82 points. But hey, you know, it's still early, only 9 games, like you said. But Hughes is his second star for the month of October. And then his first star, all by himself, second in league scoring, Elias Pettersson, 16 points in 9 games, finished the month with a hat trick on Halloween. The guy is a superstar. It's gonna cost this team. The price just keeps going up for that extension for Elias Pettersson. But those repeats 3 stars for the month of October. Who are your 3 stars, Brendan?
Okay, well, same 3 players, different grouping. I'm going number 3, Elias Pettersson. I mean, again, like, I mean, really, I mean, there's no quibble with any of these guys. You could throw them in any spot. But, you know, obviously second in the league in scoring. So I'm not going to sit here and, you know, argue that that Pete made him number 1, because there's nothing really to argue with that. My number 2 is JT Miller. I just think he's been their best forward consistently. You know, Pettersson has the points, but, you know, that line with DiGiuseppe, Miller, and Besser has just been fantastic. I mean, they get the way that Tocchet wants them to play at his, and they have been just consistently good. You know, Miller had his hiccup in the last game against Nashville, and that's all it was, because he ends up scoring, you know, an insurance goal to make it 4-2. And you know, I mean, I'm not going to sit here and argue that he hasn't been their best forward. He's just been consistent on the forecheck and very good. And then number 1, I think, is Quinn Hughes. I think Quinn Hughes has been phenomenal. I mean, he's had one bad period, and that was the period against Nashville, but he's just been exceptional. He's been, you know, arguably the best defenseman in the NHL through 9-10 games. And I mean, what else do you say? I mean, I could sit there and watch that guy skate for hours. I mean, it's just a beautiful thing to watch, and something you can't teach. And I mean, I do hope fans appreciate what they're seeing, because, you know, you're seeing one of the best defensemen to ever, well, no, I will say it, probably the best defenseman to ever put on a Canuck uniform.
Yeah, I agree. I definitely think he is the best defenseman to ever put on a Canuck uniform. My 3 stars are a little bit different than your guys's. My third star is Filip Hronek. I honestly, the guy's got 8 points in 9 games. He looks really good on the back end, especially paired with Quinn Hughes. I just think he is looking like a real, real rock solid acquisition by this management group. We really needed a legitimate kind of top 2 right shot defenseman, which we really haven't had since Christian Ehrhoff, I believe, was a right shot defenseman. Sammy Salo, maybe, or no.
I mean, maybe
Dan Hamuse, I guess, but Hamuse never put up the offensive points, kind of like what Hronek's been putting up recently. My second star is going to be Elias Pettersson. Again, second in league scoring. He's been outstanding. His 2-way game has really developed. Like you said, wasn't his best game last night, but ended the month on a hat trick. Huge. And I'm with you, Brendan. The number 1 star for the month of October for me is Quinn Hughes. Hughes, you know, coming into the season, had a lot of pressure on him being named the captain. He's been phenomenal. He has been absolutely phenomenal. He has, anytime the puck is on his stick, he makes something happen. You know, he is shooting the puck at a far higher rate than he normally does. He already has 3 goals on the year. I think it was Jeff Patterson tweeted this out, that Hughes got his 3rd goal last year. I think it was like in January 6th, Hughes got his 3rd goal of the season. And he's got 3 goals within the first month of the season for the Canucks. Quinn Hughes is my first star of the month. All right. I guess it's time for us to head into the free pour segment. I just wanted to talk, and again, it's a little bit sad, but I wanted to talk about the tragic loss of Matthew Perry. I've never been a Friends fan. I was never a big fan of Friends, the television show. But his character on Friends, Chandler, was the only, in my opinion, actually truly funny character on the show. I thought all of the other ones were like almost like cartoon caricatures of real people. Chandler was the only person who, to me, was a believable real person and a real character. And you're just hearing a lot of these people talk about Matthew Perry, the person. Hank Azaria shared a really nice story about how he helped him get sober. And, you know, Matthew Perry, you know, suffered, you know, with alcoholism and addiction. And, you know, it was an ongoing battle. And I just wanted to, you know, say how sad it is Canadian as well. How sad it is to see, you know, a Canadian comedic icon like Matthew Perry pass away.
Yeah, I mean, that was shocking.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, given his history, I mean, you're not going to sit here and go, I mean, you didn't think it could happen. And but, you know, when it did happen, it was just like, it just seemed like he got his life just on track. And, you know, that's a sad thing sometimes, you know. I mean, you know, you just seem like you get it back on track and, you know, it just ends tragically like that. And, yeah, I mean, he's an icon. I mean, and you know, regardless of whether you like that show, and I mean, I was a fan of the show, and I mean, Chandler was my favorite character by far. I mean, all six of those actors were icons. I respect the fact that they did remain really close, because that industry does suffer a lot of egos and jealousies and all of that, and they managed to remain very close throughout and remain really close friends, you know, up until his passing. So I can't imagine how, you know, because they went from obscure actors to a worldwide phenomenon, you know, in the matter of a year. I don't know, I couldn't imagine what that would feel like. And so for them to remain close throughout, you know, I mean, I've got a lot of time for that. You know, rest in peace, Matthew Perry, and condolences to his family and everybody who loved him.
Yeah.
This is a really sad episode, because mine's going to hear as I put mine up. Like, mine's sad too.
Oh, like, is it?
Not, okay. Like, yeah, mine's really, really sad.
All right.
Hold on here. Let me get my background up here for people who are not listening on or watching on YouTube. I do put up pictures every time, so I will have one up here in just 1 second, because it this one is kind of, it's a very sad anniversary. Okay, well, that's good. There you go.
Ah, yes, yes.
So this is a very sad. Now you can't see the guy on the. Well, there you go. It's a very sad anniversary. It's the 21st
Payne
anniversary.
Stewart, right? That's Payne Stewart on the left.
That's Payne
my
Stewart.
Left, your right. Yeah.
Yeah. So we've got. Yeah. It was just. I remember this in 1999. I was a teenager. I remember first. I think it was October the 25th. Payne Stewart and his entourage died in a Learjet crash. Cabin had a catastrophic depressurization. It killed them all, and the plane just kind of went on this crazy little journey out into the, until it ran out of gas and crashed into a field. And then just a few days later, you know, Greg Moore dies tragically in an IndyCar accident, which was, I mean, I remember I was watching that race live, and you know, I was watching IndyCar a lot at that point, just because you had this guy from Maple Ridge who was just a phenomenon. He was supposed to be the next big thing. He was moving to Penske, which was arguably the biggest racing, I think it was the best racing team in Indy, and he was ready to dominate that circuit. And it was just, I mean, that was just such an awful week, you know, to lose, you know, Payne Stewart, who had just won the U.S. Open a few months before, and then helped lead America to that crazy Ryder Cup win at Brookline in 1999. And, you know, to have him die that way at the age of 42, and then, you know, Greg Moore at the age of just 24 years old. It was just such an awful week. And I think a lot of us who are that remember that time remember that week. It was just awful. And, you know, I often look at Greg Moore being that young and wonder what he could have done, because I think he was on the verge of becoming something really special, not just in IndyCar. I think he would have probably gone on to, you know, he was already driving, and there's this clip on YouTube of him doing stock car racing against Dale Earnhardt Sr. So he was branching out, and whether it was NASCAR or F1, he was going somewhere that wasn't IndyCar. And, you know, I mean, I think most people agree he had an opportunity to be one of the greatest racers ever. And it's just, it was, you know, I mean, that track that he died on, they ended up fixing it the next year, and it just, And just to be a local guy too, which is, you know, I posted it the other day, and I had a lot of local people saying that they weren't racing fans, but it really hit them hard. And I think it hit, you know, a lot of us hard, you know, regardless of whether you were a racing fan or not, because he was a local guy, you know, on the verge of being just a superstar in his sport.
Well, let's move on to the outro then. It's been a really fun episode. The first episode, Pete's never been on. So, you know, I think we held the fort down pretty good, Brendan. I don't know. I thought we held it down pretty good.
Yeah. Hell with Pete. I think we should. Who's going to send him the message to say he's cut? You or me?
I'll leave it with you. I'll leave it with you. yeah, I mean, look, I think, you know, trying to uplift this episode for the ending here, you know, I do think, you know, Canuck fans are happy, you know, they're cheering for the team. It's nice to talk about the team, you know. The fact that the fans were so mad after that Rangers game for that missed call on Petey, it was just great to see. It's great to see the fan base slowly come together again. And I know we've said this a couple times on this episode, it's only 9 games in, but it's nice to see.
It's only 9 games. That doesn't mean you can't enjoy it. You know, enjoy yourself. That's what sports are for.
Exactly. You can follow us on Twitter. Be sure to follow @PeteGass. It's @Pete_Gass. You can follow me @DougVen. Be sure to follow the podcast on Twitter @CanucksSpeak.
Me @Jabo, JABO _ Vancouver. And of course, if you're watching us on YouTube, and there's apparently, according to Doug, multiple buttons that you should be hitting, like notifications, subscription, just hit all of them, you know, they're all good. So yes, hit those.
Well, especially since they got rid of the dislike button. So yeah, you don't have to worry about people hitting that button anymore. It's no longer
cheers.
There.
Cheers, YouTube.
Cheers. Anyways, thanks for listening, and we'll see you guys next week. Come on, come on.